You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. Papa and the Boy by J.L. Harbor. Charming as is the merry prattle of innocent childhood, it is not particularly agreeable at about 1 o'clock in the morning. There are young and talkative children who have no more regard for your feelings or for the proprieties of life than to open their eyes with a snap at 1 or 2 in the morning and to seek to engage you in enlivening dialogue of this sort.
Papa?
You think you will pay no heed to the imperative little voice, hoping that silence on your part will keep the youngster quiet. But again, that boy of 3 pipes out sharply,
Papa?
Well, you say?
You wake, Papa?
Yes.
So's me.
Yes, I hear that you are, you say with cold sarcasm. What do you want?
Oh, nothing.
Well, lie still and go to sleep then.
I isn't sleepy, Papa.
Well, I am, young man.
Is you? I isn't. Not a bit. Say, Papa, if you was a witch, what would you buy me?
I don't know. Go to sleep.
Wouldn't you buy me nothing?
I guess so. Now you...
What, Papa?
Well, a steam engine, maybe. Now, you go right to sleep.
With a bell that would ring, Papa?
Yes. Now you...
And would the wheels go round, Papa?
Oh, yes. Shut your eyes now and...
And would it go choo, choo, choo? Papa?
Yes. Now go to sleep.
Say, Papa.
No answer.
Papa?
Well, what now?
Is you afraid of the dark?
No.
I isn't either, Papa.
Well?
If I was witch, I'd buy you something.
Would you?
Yes, I'd buy you some ice cream and some chocolate drops and a toothbrush and panties with braid on like mine and a candy rooster and...
That will do. You must go to sleep now. Silence for half a second, then...
Papa!
Well, what now?
I want a jink.
No, you don't.
I do, Papa.
Experience has taught you that there will be no peace until you have brought the jink, and you scurry out to the bathroom in the dark for it, knocking your shins against everything in the room as you go. Now, I don't want to hear another word from you tonight, you say, as he gulps down a mouthful of the water he didn't want. 2 minutes later, he says,
Papa!
See here, laddie, Papa will have to punish you if...
I can spell dog, Papa.
Well, nobody wants to hear you spell at 2 o'clock in the morning.
B-O-G. Dog. Is that right?
No, it isn't. But nobody cares if...
Then it's D-O-G. Isn't it?
Yes. Now, you lie right down and go to sleep instantly.
Then I'll be a good boy, won't I, Papa?
Yes, you'll be the best boy on earth. Good night, dearie.
Papa?
Well, what now?
Is I your little boy?
Yes, of course.
Some men's haven't got any little boys, but you have, haven't you?
Yes.
Don't you wish you had 2, 3, 9, 11, 26, 90, 10, 300 little boys?
The mere possibility of such a remote and contingent calamity so paralyzes you that you lie speechless for 10 minutes, during which you hear a yawn or two in the little bed by your side. A little figure rolls over 3 or 4 times. A pair of heels fly into the air once or twice. A warm, moist little hand reaches out and touches your face to make sure that you are there. And the boy is asleep with his heels where his head ought to be. The Patent Gas Regulator by Charles Bertrand Lewis. I was thinking today that it was about time, observed Mrs. Bowser, as Mr. Bowser came home the other evening with a suspicious-looking package under his arm. About time for what? I suppose you've run across some more germ killer, or a new kind of medicine chest, or a pocket fire escape. How on earth you let people take you in as they do is a wonder to me. Who has ever taken me in? He hotly demanded. Everybody who had anything in the shape of a swindle? I deny it. You can't point to one single instance where I have made a poor investment. On the contrary, I have saved us hundreds of dollars per year in cold cash, not to mention sickness, suffering, and doctor's bills, by the outlay of a few shillings now and then. What new idea is it this time? She asked, as she resigned herself to the inevitable. Mrs. Bowser, he replied, after walking back and forth across the room 3 or 4 times. If I can save 1/2 of our gas bill just as well as not, I'd be a chump not to do it, wouldn't I? We can save it all by burning kerosene. Don't try to be funny, Mrs. Bowser. The gas bill is a serious thing. If I can save anywhere from $30 to $40 per month by the outlay of a couple of dollars at the start, common sense dictates my course. If I didn't save to offset your waste, we should soon be in the poorhouse. The gas bill for last month was something appalling. It was $4.20, I believe. What you believe has nothing to do with the matter. If it wasn't $75 or $80, it will be this month. Mrs. Bowser, do you know the principle on which a gas meter works? No. Of course not. And yet you assume to criticize my actions. There is a bellows inside the meter. The bellows is arranged to force the gas through the pipes faster than it can be burned, and thereby profit the gas company. We have paid out thousands of dollars for gas we never burned, and the time has come to call a halt. Well, I have here a patent regulator. It is attached to the inlet pipe. With this on, the pressure is decreased and no gas wasted. Any child can attach it. It is simple, compact, and nothing about it to get out of order. By the expenditure of $4, I save hundreds. Well, don't blame me if it doesn't work. And I'm sure it won't. Because I wish to save $1,000 instead of giving it to the gas company, you are sure it won't work. Is it any wonder, Mrs. Bowser, that so many husbands throw their dollars away and pauperize their families? You object to my scheme. Of course you'd object. Nevertheless, the attachment will be attached, and before 9 o'clock tonight, the president of our gas company will hear something drop. After dinner, Mr. Bowser armed himself with a monkey wrench, a hammer, a pair of pincers, a hatchet, a saw, and other things, and disappeared in the cellar. And 1/2 hour later came upstairs to rub his hands and chuckle and announce, "The president of the gas company is already beginning to grow white round the mouth, Mrs. Bowser. He won't put in 4 weeks at the Catskills next summer on our cash. Can't you see the difference already?" "I see no difference whatever," she replied, as she looked up at the chandelier. "Of course not. I didn't expect you would. When a wife is determined to bankrupt her husband, she can't see anything indeed to save a dollar. The regulator is regulating, however, and I feel as if a great burden had rolled off my back." 12 times during the evening, Mr. Bowser got up to walk about and chuckle and refer to that regulator, and he went to bed figuring that the gas company would be financially busted in 6 months. He hadn't got to sleep when Mrs. Bowser asked him if he didn't smell gas.
"Not a smell," he replied as he turned over. "The president of the gas company probably smells a rat, but there is no odor of gas here."
It was daylight next morning when a policeman rang the doorbell and banged away till he got Mr. Bowser downstairs and said,
"I've been smelling gas around here all night. You'd better look at your meter. The odor seems to come from that open cellar window."
He went down with Mr. Bowser to investigate. The regulator and the inlet pipe had parted company, and for 8 or 9 hours, the gas had been steadily pouring out of the open window and sailing around the corner of the house. At the breakfast table, after the plumber and the policeman and the crowd had departed, and the house had been aired, and the cook's wages raised 50 cents a week to keep her on, Mrs. Bowser looked up and asked,
"Mr. Bowser, if you call it 8 hours, how much gas will have gone out of that window?"
He pretended not to hear, and hadn't a word to say until he stood at the door, ready to go to the office. Then he turned on her with,
"You can figure it with your lawyer. You can give him the exact hour you sneaked down there and uncoupled that regulator to spite me, and he can work it out. While you are not entitled to alimony, I am willing, for the sake of our child, that you should have a reasonable sum until you can learn to make straw hats or hickory shirts. Farewell, Mrs. Bowser. The worm has turned."
But the worm returned home at the usual hour. And 2 days later, when Mrs. Bowser saw the patent gas regulator in the backyard and asked what it was, he quietly replied,
"It's probably an old beer faucet the green heaved at those howling cats last night."
An Unmarried Female by Marietta Holly.
I suppose we are about as happy as the most of folks, but as I was saying a few days ago to Betsy Bobbitt, a neighbor and female of ours, every station house in life has its various skeletons. But we ought to try to be contented with that sphere of life we are called on to handle. Betsy ain't married, and she don't seem to be contented. She is awful opposed to women's rights. She thinks it is women's only sphere to marry. But as yet, she can't find any man willing to lay hold of that sphere with her. But you can read in her daily life and on her eager, willing countenance that she fully realizes the sweet words of the poet, "While there is life, there is hope." Betsy ain't handsome. Her cheekbones are high, and she being not much more than skin and bone, they show plainer than they would if she was in good order. Her complexion, not that I blame her for it, ain't good, and her eyes are little and sought way back in her head. Time has seen fit to deprive her of her hair and teeth, but her large nose he has kindly suffered her to keep. But she has got the best white ivory teeth money will buy, and 2 long curls fastened behind each ear, besides frizzles on the top of her head. And if she wasn't naturally bald, and if the curls was the color of her hair, they would look well. She is awful sentimental. I have seen a good many that had it bad, but of all the sentimental creatures I ever did see, Betty Bobbitt is the sentimentalist. You couldn't squeeze a laugh out of her with a cheese press. As I said, she is awful opposed to women's having any right, only the right to get married. She holds on to that right as tight as any single woman I ever see, which makes it hard and wearying on the single men round here. For take the men that are the most opposed to women's having a right and talk the most about being her duty to cling to man like a vine to a tree. They don't want Betsy to cling to them. They won't let her cling to them. For when they would be a-going on about how wicked it was for women to vote and it was her only spear to marry, says I to them, "Which had you rather do, let Betsy Bobbitt cling to you or let her vote?" And they would every one of them quail before that question. They would drop their heads before my keen gray eyes and move off the subject. But Betsy don't get discouraged. Every time I see her, she says in a hopeful, wishful tone, that the deepest man of minds in the country agree with her in thinking that it is women's duty to marry and not to vote. And then she talks aside about the retiring modesty and dignity of the fair sect, and how shameful and revolting it would be to see women throwing them away and boldly and unblushingly talking about law and justice. Why, to hear Betsy Bobbitt talk about women's throwing their modesty away, you would think if they ever went to the political poll, they would have to take their dignity and modesty and throw them against the poll and go without any all the rest of their lives. Now, I don't believe in no such stuff as that. I think a woman can be bold and unwomanly in other things besides going with a thick veil over her face and a brass-mounted parasol once a year and gently and quietly dropping a vote for a Christian president or a religious and noble-minded pathmaster. She thinks she talks dreadful polite and proper. She says, "I was Cayman," instead of "I was coming," and "I have saw," instead of "I have seen," and "paper" for paper, and "dia" for dear. I don't know much about grammar, but common sense goes a good ways. She writes the poetry for the Jonesville Auger, or Auga, as she calls it. She used to write for the opposition paper, the Jonesville Gimlet, but the editor of the Auger, a long-haired chap who moved into Jonesville a few months ago, lost his wife soon after he come there, and since that, she has turned Democrat and writes for his papers, did he? They say that he is a dreadful big-feeling man, and I have heard. It came right straight to me. His cousin's wife's sister told it to the mother-in-law of one of my neighbor's brother's wife, that he didn't like Betsy's poetry at all, and he printed it, for was to plague the editor of the Gimlet, because she used to write for him. I myself wouldn't give a cent a bushel for all the poetry she can write. And it seems to me that if I was Betsy, I wouldn't try to write so much. Howsomever, I don't know what turn I should take if I was Betsy Bobbitt. That is a solemn subject, and one I don't love to think on. I never shall forget the first piece of her poetry I ever see. Josiah Allen and I had both on us been married going on a year, and I had occasion to go to his trunk one day, where he kept a lot of old papers. And the first thing I laid my hand on was these verses. Josiah went with her a few times after his wife died, on the 4th of July or so, and two or three camp meetings, and the poetry seemed to be wrote about the time we was married. It was directed over the top of it. Ode to Josiah. Just as if she were in debt to him. This was the way it read. Ode to Josiah. Josiah, I the tale have hearn, with rigid ear and streaming eye. I saw from me that you did turn. I never knew the reason why. Oh, Josiah, it seemed as if I must expire. Why did you, oh, why did you blow upon my life of snowy sleet, the fire of love to fiercest glow, then turn a damper on the heat? Oh, Josiah, it seemed as if I must expire. I saw thee coming down the street, she by your side in bonnet blue. The stuns that grated neath thy feet seemed crunching on my vitals too. Oh, Josiah, it seemed as if I must expire. I saw thee washing sheep last night. On the bridge I stood with marble brow. The waters raged, thou clasped it tight. I sighed, should both be drowned now. I thought, Josiah, O happy sheep, to thus expire. I showed the poetry to Josiah that night after he came home, and told him I had read it. He looked awful ashamed to think I had seen it, and says he, with a dreadful sheepish look, "The persecution I underwent from that female can never be told. She fairly hunted me down. I hadn't no rest for the soles of my feet. I thought one spell she would marry me in spite of all I could do, without giving me the benefit of law or gospel." He see I look stern, and he added with a sick-looking smile, "I thought one spell," to use Betsy's language, "I was a goner." I didn't smile. Oh, no. For the deep principle of my sect was reared up. I says to him in a tone cold enough to almost freeze his ears, Josiah Allen, shut up. Of all the cowardly things a man ever done, it is going round bragging about women liking them and following them up. Any man that'll do that is little enough to crawl through a knothole without rubbing his clothes, says I. I suppose you made her think the moon rose in your head and set in your heels. I dare say you acted foolish enough round her to sicken a snipe. And if you makes fun of her now to please me, I'll let you know you have got hold of the wrong individual. Now, says I, go to bed. And I added, in still more freezing accents, for I want to mend your pantaloons. He gathered up his shoes and stockings and started off to bed, and we hain't never passed a word on the subject since. I believe when you disagree with your partner, in freeing your mind in the first on't, and then not to be a-twittin' about it afterward. And as for being jealous, I should just as soon think of being jealous of a meeting house as I should of Josiah. He is a well-principled man, and I guess he wasn't fur out of the way about Betsy Bobbitt, though I wouldn't encourage him by letting him say a word on the subject, for I always make it a rule to stand up for my own sect. But when I hear her go on about the editor of the Auger, I can believe anything about Betsy Bobbitt. She came in here one day last week. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I had got my house slick as a pin and my dinner underway. I was going to have a bile dinner and a cherry pudding biled with sweet sass to eat on it. And I sat down to finish sewing up the breadth of my new rag carpet. I thought I would get it done while I hadn't so much to do, for it being the 1st of March, I knew sugaring would be coming on, and then cleaning house time, and I wanted it to put down just as soon as the stove was carried out in the summer kitchen. The fire was sparkling away, and the painted floor a-shining, and the dinner a-biling. I sat there, sewing just as calm as a clock, not dreaming of no trouble, when in came Betsy Bobbitt. I met her with outward calm, and asked her to sit down and lay off her things. She sat down, but she said she couldn't lay off her things, says she. I was coming down past, and I thought I would call and let you see the last number of the Auger. There is a piece in it concerning the tariff that stirs men's souls. I like it ever so much. She handed me the paper, folded so I couldn't see nothing but a piece of poetry by Betsy Bobbitt. I see what she wanted of me, so I dropped my breadths of carpeting and took hold of it and began to read it. Read it audible, if you please, says she, especially the precious remarks over it. It is such a feast for me to be a-sittin' and hear it rehearsed by a musical force. Says I suppose I can rehearse it if it will do you any good. So I began as follows. It is seldom that we present to the readers of the Auger the best paper for the fireside in Jonesville or the world, with a poem like the following. It may be, by the assistance of the Auger, only 12 shillings a year in advance, wood and potatoes taken in exchange, the name of Betsy Bobbitt will yet be carved on the lofty pinnacle of fame's towering pillow. We think, however, that she could study such writers as Sylvanus Cobb and Tupper with profit both to herself and to them, editor of the Auger. Here Betsy interrupted me. The dear editor of the Auger has no need to advise me to read Tupper, for he is indeed my most favorite author. You have devoured him, haven't you, Josiah Allen's wife? Devoured who? Says I, in a tone pretty near as cold as a cold icicle. Martin Farquhar Tupper, that sweet author, says she. No, ma'am, says I shortly. I hain't devoured Martin Farquhar Tupper, nor no other man. I hain't a cannibal. Oh, you understand me not. I meant devoured his sweet tender lines. I hain't devoured his tender lines nor nothing relating to him. And I made a motion to lay the paper down, but Betsy urged me to go on, and so I read. Gushings of a Tender Soul. O let who will, O let who can, be tied unto a horrid male man. Thus said I ere, my tender heart was touched. Thus said I ere, my tender feelings gushed. But oh, a change hath swept o'er me, as billows sweep the deep blue sea. A voice, a noble form, one day I saw. An arrow flew, my heart is nearly raw. His first partner lies beneath the turf. He is wandering now in sorrow's briny surf. Two twins, the little death cherub creatures, now wipe the tears from off his classic features. O sweet lot, worthy angel arisen, to wipe tears from eyes like his'n. What you think of it? Says she, as I finished reading. I looked right at her, most a minute with a majestic look. In spite of her false curls and her new white ivory teeth, she is a humbly critter. I looked at her silently while she sought and twisted her long yellow bonnet strings, and then I spoke out. Hain't the editor of the Auger a widower with a pair of twins? Yes, says she, with a happy look. Then says I, if the man hain't a fool, he'll think you are one. Oh, says she, and she dropped her bonnet strings and clasped her long bony hands together in her brown cotton gloves. Oh, we ardent souls of genius have feelings you cold, practical natures know nothing of, and if they did not gush out in poetry, we should expire. You may as well try to tie up the gushing cataract of Niagara with a piece of welting cord as to tie up the feelings of an ardent soul. Ardent soul, says I coldly, which makes the most noise, Betsy Bobbitt, a 3-inch brook or a 10-footer? Which is the terror? Which is the roarer? Deep waters run stillest. I have no faith in feelings that talk round in public in mourning weeds. I have no faith in such mourners, says I. Oh, Josiah's wife, cold, practical female being, you know me not. We are sundered as far apart as if you were sitting on the North Pole and I was sitting on the South Pole. Uncongenial being, you know me not. I may not know you, Betsy Bobbitt, but I do know decency, and I know that no money would tempt me to write such stuff as that poetry and send it to a widower with twins. Oh, says she, what appeals to the tender feeling heart of a single female woman more than to see a lonely man who has lost his relict? And pity never seems so much like pity when it is given to the dear little children of widowers. And, says she, I think more than as likely as not, this soaring soul of genius did not wed his affinity, but was united to a mere woman of clay. Mere woman of clay, says I, fixing my spectacles upon her in a most searching manner. Where will you find a woman, Betsy Bobbitt, that hain't more or less clay? An affinity, that is the meanest word I ever heard. No married woman has any right to hear it. I'll excuse you being a female, but if a man had said it to me, I'd holler to Josiah. There is a time for everything, and the time to hunt affinity is before you are married. Married folks hain't no right to hunt it, says I sternly. We kindred souls soar above such petty feelings. We soar far above them. I hain't much of a soarer, says I. And I don't pretend to be. And to tell you the truth, says I am glad I hain't. The editor of the Auger, said she, and she grasped the paper off on the stand and folded it up and presented it at me like a spear. The editor of this paper is a kindred soul. He appreciates me. He understands me. And will not our names in the pages of this very paper go down to posterity together? Then, says I, drove out of all patience with her. I wish you was there now, both of you. I wish, says I, looking fixedly on her. I wish you was both of you in posterity now.
You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.